Leaving aside the libertines, we know that the deists were certainly given their full chance. It is quite probable, in fact, that the first four presidents of the United States were deists. Jefferson certainly did not believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, and while he was president, wrote a version of the four Gospels from which he removed all references to fantastic events, retaining only the ethical content of Jesus' teaching. Legend has it that when Jefferson was elected president, old women hid their Bibles and shed tears. What they might have done had Tom Paine become president or been offered some high post in the government is hard to imagine. In the Age of Reason, Paine attacked the Bible and all subsequent Christian theology. Of Jesus Christ, Paine allowed that he was a virtuous and amiable man, but charged that the stories of his divinity were absurd and profane, which, in the way of the rationalist, he tried to prove by a close textual analysis of the Bible. All national institutions of churches, he wrote, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions, set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. Because of the Age of Reason, Paine lost his standing among the pantheon of founding fathers, and to this day is treated ambiguously in American history textbooks. But Ezra Stiles did not say that libertines and deists would be loved, only that with reason as their jury they would have their say in an open court, as indeed they did. Assisted by the initial enthusiasms evoked by the French Revolution, the deist attack on churches as enemies of progress and on religious superstition as enemy of rationality became a popular movement. The churches fought back, of course, and when deism ceased to attract interest, they fought among themselves. Toward the mid-18th century, Theodore Frelinghuysen and William Tennant led a revivalist movement among Presbyterians. They were followed by the three great figures associated with religious awakenings in America: Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and later in the 19th century, Charles Finney. These men were spectacularly successful preachers, whose appeal reached regions of consciousness far beyond where reason rules. Of Whitefield, it was said that by merely pronouncing the word Mesopotamia, he evoked tears in his audience. Perhaps that is why Henry Coswell remarked in 1839 that religious mania is said to be the prevailing form of insanity in the United States. Yet it is essential to bear in mind that quarrels over doctrine between the revivalist movements of the 18th and 19th centuries and the established churches fiercely opposed to them were argued in pamphlets and books in largely rational, logically ordered language. It would be a serious mistake to think of Billy Graham or any other television revivalist as a latter-day Jonathan Edwards or Charles Finney. Edwards was one of the most brilliant and creative minds ever produced by America. His contribution to aesthetic theory was almost as important as his contribution to theology. His interests were mostly academic. He spent long hours each day in his study. He did not speak to his audiences extemporaneously. He read his sermons, which were tightly knit and closely reasoned expositions of theological doctrine. Audiences may have been moved emotionally by Edwards' language, but they were, first and foremost, required to understand it. Indeed, Edwards' fame was largely a result of a book, Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God in the Conversion of Many Hundred Souls in Northampton, published in 1737. A later book, A Treatise Concerning Religious Affections, published in 1746, is considered to be among the most remarkable psychological studies ever produced in America. Unlike the principal figures in today's Great Awakening, Oral Roberts, Jerry Falwell, Jimmy Swaggart, et al., yesterday's leaders of revivalist movements in America were men of learning, faith in reason, and generous expository gifts. Their disputes with the religious establishments were as much about theology and the nature of consciousness as they were about religious inspiration. Finney, for example, was no backcountry rustic as he was sometimes characterized by his doctrinal opponents. He had been trained as a lawyer, wrote an important book on systematic theology, and ended his career as a professor at and then president of Oberlin College. The doctrinal disputes among religionists not only were argued in carefully drawn exposition in the 18th century, but in the 19th century were settled by the extraordinary expedient of founding colleges. It is sometimes forgotten that the churches in America laid the foundation of our system of higher education. Harvard, of course, was established early in 1636 for the purpose of providing learned ministers to the Congregational Church, and 65 years later, when Congregationalists quarreled among themselves over doctrine, Yale College was founded to correct the lax influences of Harvard, and to this day claims it has the same burden. The strong intellectual strain of the Congregationalists was matched by other denominations, certainly in their passion for starting colleges. The Presbyterians founded, among other schools, the University of Tennessee in 1784, Washington and Jefferson in 1802, and Lafayette in 1826. The Baptists founded, among others, Colgate, 1817, George Washington, 1821, Furman, 1826, Denison, 1832, and Wake Forest, 1834. The Episcopalians founded Hobart, 1822, Trinity, 1823, and Kenyon, 1824. The Methodists founded 8 colleges between 1830 and 1851, including Wesleyan, Emory, and DePauw. In addition to Harvard and Yale, the Congregationalists founded Williams, 1793, Middlebury, 1800, Amherst, 1821, and Oberlin, 1833. If this preoccupation with literacy and learning be a form of insanity, as Coswell said, of religious life in America, then let there be more of it. In the 18th and 19th centuries, religious thought and institutions in America were dominated by an austere, learned, and intellectual form of discourse that is largely absent from religious life today. No clearer example of the difference between earlier and modern forms of public discourse can be found than in the contrast between the theological arguments of Jonathan Edwards and those of, say, Jerry Falwell or Billy Graham or Oral Roberts. The formidable content to Edwards' theology must inevitably engage the intellect. If there is such a content to the theology of the television evangelicals, they have not yet made it known. The differences between the character of discourse in a print-based culture and the character of discourse in a television-based culture are also evident if one looks at the legal system. In a print-based culture, lawyers tended to be well-educated, devoted to reason, and capable of impressive expositional argument. It is a matter frequently overlooked in histories of America that in the 18th and 19th centuries, the legal profession represented a sort of privileged body in the scale of intellect, as Tocqueville remarked. Folk heroes were made of some of those lawyers, like Sergeant Prentice of Alabama or Honest Abe Lincoln of Illinois, whose craftiness in manipulating juries was highly theatrical, not unlike television's version of a trial lawyer. But the great figures of American jurisprudence, John Marshall, Joseph Story, James Kent, David Hoffman, William Wirt, and Daniel Webster, were models of intellectual elegance and devotion to rationality and scholarship. They believed that democracy, for all of its obvious virtues, posed the danger of releasing an undisciplined individualism. Their aspiration was to save civilization in America by creating a rationality for the law. As a consequence of this exalted view, they believed that law must not be merely a learned profession, but a liberal one. The famous law professor Job Tyson argued that a lawyer must be familiar with the works of Seneca, Cicero, and Plato. George Sharswood, perhaps envisioning the degraded state of legal education in the 20th century, remarked in 1854 that to read law exclusively will damage the mind, shackle it to the technicalities with which it has become so familiar, and disable it from taking enlarged and comprehensive views even of topics falling within its compass. The insistence on a liberal, rational, and articulate legal mind was reinforced by the fact that America had a written constitution, as did all of its component states, and that law did not grow by chance, but was explicitly formulated. A lawyer needed to be a writing and reading man par excellence, for reason was the principal authority upon which legal questions were to be decided. John Marshall was, of course, the great paragon of reason, as vivid a symbol to the American imagination as Natty Bumppo. He was the preeminent example of typographic man, detached, analytical, devoted to logic, abhorring contradiction. It was said of him that he never used analogy as a principal support of his arguments. Rather, he introduced most of his decisions with the phrase, "It is admitted." Once one admitted his premises, one was usually forced to accept his conclusion. To an extent difficult to imagine today, earlier Americans were familiar not only with the great legal issues of their time, but even with the language famous lawyers had used to argue their cases. This was especially true of Daniel Webster, and it was only natural that Stephen Vincent Benet, in his famous short story, would have chosen Daniel Webster to contend with the devil. How could the devil triumph over a man whose language, described by Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, had the following characteristics? His clearness and downright simplicity of statement, his vast comprehensiveness of topics, his fertility in illustrations drawn from practical sources, his keen analysis and suggestion of difficulties, his power of disentangling a complicated proposition and resolving it in elements so plain as to reach the most common minds, his vigor in generalizations, planting his own arguments behind the whole battery of his opponents, his wariness and caution not to betray himself by heat into untenable positions or to spread his forces over useless ground. I quote this in full because it is the best 19th century description I know of the character of discourse expected of one whose mind is formed by the printed word. It is exactly the ideal and model James Mill had in mind in prophesying about the wonders of typography, and if the model was somewhat unreachable, it stood nonetheless as an ideal to which every lawyer aspired.